Peter B. Collins News and Comment. It's Thursday, April 17, 2014. It is Holy Week on the Christian calendar, and this will be my last podcast before Easter Sunday. We'll be off on Friday, and I'll be with you this coming Monday, and then we'll have 4 days off due to some business conflicts that will prevent me from giving you a daily update. But as we approach Easter, and I am not a believer, but I respect those who are, a coalition of Christian leaders citing the spirit of Holy Week has called for an end to mass incarceration in the United States and an end to the war on some drugs. The Reverend Edwin Sanders, senior servant and founder of the Metropolitan Interdenominational Church in Nashville, said, "We are called upon to follow Jesus' example in opposing the war on drugs, which has resulted in the United States becoming the world's biggest jailer, with about 5% of the world's population and 25% of the world's prisoners. And, of course, these factors impact minorities in a disproportionate manner." What would Jesus say? What would Jesus do? Well, if you believe in him as your Lord and Savior, as a God figure, I ask you to ponder that and work to raise awareness and to push for real reform. There is some movement in the country. And while I'm a sharp critic of the president and his attorney general, Eric Holder, they are moving in the right direction, promising to commute more of those draconian sentences for minor drug offenses and trying to roll back some of the sentencing guidelines that have produced these really unjust outcomes. And the whole spirit of Easter is that of resurrection, renewal, forgiveness. I wish it lasted a little bit longer because they're wonderful, wonderful expressions. They just don't get enough mileage. And if Jesus were here today, I think that he would be trying to defuse the situation in Ukraine. And on the one hand today, John Kerry and his counterpart, Lavrov, the foreign minister of Russia, met in Geneva and announced that they have reached an agreement that grants amnesty to members of armed groups who agree to leave public buildings that they've been occupying. All sides must refrain from any violence, intimidation, or provocative actions, the joint statement said. The participants strongly condemned and rejected all expressions of extremism, racism, and religious intolerance, including anti-Semitism. Now, whether the agreement will de-escalate the crisis or how quickly remains very unclear, and I would say that while this is a nice news release and a photo op, the facts on the ground are in conflict. Russia Today, the Russian television network, is reporting 3 people killed, 13 others injured by gunfire in a confrontation between anti-government protesters and soldiers at a military base in the Ukrainian city of Mariupol. Now, of course, this is coming from Russian sources, and we have to treat it accordingly. But they also report that 63 people were detained overnight following the incident, 25 released within hours. And, you know, we have a very volatile situation there. And here comes Vladimir Putin, who on an annual basis sits down and takes questions from Russians. And this time it was including a famous expatriate currently living near Moscow, a guy named Ed Snowden. So Snowden apparently videotaped his question. It was played back. Now, let me be clear that this is all done for show. But the optics of this show are a lot better than what we get here in the United States. So, here we have Putin. He views the question from Snowden. And then he says, well, let's talk spook. He replied, Mr. Snowden, you are a former agent. I used to work for an intelligence service. Let's speak in a professional language. And the question that Snowden had asked is, does Russia intercept, store, or analyze in any way the communications of millions of individuals? Putin's answer, our intelligence efforts are strictly regulated by our law. You have to get a court's permission first. Noting that terrorists use electronic communications, Putin said that Russia, of course, used surveillance. But we don't use this on such a massive scale, and I hope that we won't. Now, I don't for a moment believe that this former KGB guy is actually telling the truth. And there are many examples of the duplicity that is evident in these remarks from Putin. But I just think it's interesting because Putin is playing democratic cards. They don't necessarily match his underlying motives and actions. But for public consumption, he's the guy who took over Crimea after a public vote, a referendum. Now, that was preceded by restocking of the Crimean parliament, so they would put that referendum up for a vote. But when you compare what Putin has in terms of, you know, democratic instruments or markers, what does the U.S. have? They have this rump regime in Kiev that is limping forward to elections in May, and who knows what that will produce. And in the meantime, Obama and Kerry and our neocons in the State Department are busy backpedaling, just really trying to hold the line, I guess tread water, until they can claim some greater level of legitimacy. And so it's a complex and fluid situation. We will continue to watch it here at the Peter B. Collins Podcast. I like to pause every day and thank the people who make this possible by subscribing to my little outpost of the internet here. Tom Vickery, Gary Washington, Brian Mazey, Diane Morris, they are all regular subscribers here, and I would like you to join them. Now, in case you haven't listened to it yet, in our exclusive first interview with Peter Van Buren about his new novel called The Ghosts of Tom Joad, there is an offer to new annual subscribers for a copy of this exciting new book by Peter Van Buren. And we also have, of course, great gifts for our new annual subscribers in the U.S., like this rock and roll CD from John Dist called Red Flag, a lot of good tunes on here. And we have a little bag of kick-ass Kona coffee beans that we send to our new annual subscribers. So log on to peterbcollins.com. You follow the links that say sign up right under my mugshot there in the upper left corner. You can choose $5, $10, $20 a month, or the best deal, the $50 annual subscription. And I hope you'll sign up today and support the work I'm doing here. Next week, President Obama takes off for Asia. Key meetings in Tokyo with the new conservative Prime Minister Abe. And Obama's goal is to reach agreement with Japan that will pave the way for final negotiations on the TPP, the Trans-Pacific Partnership. And this has largely been conducted out of sight. Even members of Congress or, you know, the administration expects to vote to approve this deal haven't been permitted to participate or even to see many of the documents related to it. The actual trade elements comprise only something like 5 out of 28 chapters of the agreement. And those who have seen at least parts of it have been stunned by what is in it. And we have some comment coming from our friends at Public Citizen. Here is Congresswoman Rosa DeLauro. Many of the supporters of the TPP are now arguing that its fate rests in successful bilateral trade talks with Obama and Prime Minister Abe. As the conventional wisdom goes, if Japan and the U.S. can sort out market access issues, agriculture, automobiles, then this massive trade deal can at last be concluded. This is not really the case. What the argument obscures is that TPP negotiators are grappling with many seemingly intractable problems. Intellectual property concerns threaten to limit access to affordable medicines. They're also derailing the TPP agreement. For every issue that's being intently discussed, there are others, like currency manipulation, being swept under the rug. It may be that TPP won't move forward without any addressing of the currency issue. And it's a bit odd for the president to push for TPP in Japan when he hasn't gotten fast-track negotiating authority from the Congress. And Louise Slaughter, the Southern Belle who represents Buffalo, New York in the House of Representatives. I've talked to her a number of times. She's a delightful person. She said the fast-track bill the president's trying to get approval for has no Democratic sponsors. And we had at least 30 Republican members state that they would not support fast-track. If there are no Democrats and 30 Republicans against it, that's pretty impressive. Now, one of the biggest changes for us is that Senate Finance Committee Chair Max Baucus is being replaced by Ron Wyden of Oregon. And he said he's in no rush to move fast track through his Senate committee. So there's some some games being played here, chicken and egg games, where the president is trying to force the issue forward. And I'm pleased to see that there are responsible people in Congress, mostly Democrats, who are willing to put the brakes on. And that's where it stands right now. At Guantanamo, the pretrial hearings are still suspended, and it's getting murkier there, as we now know that four FBI, either officers or officials, have been named by defense attorneys who have formally requested testimony from these officials about this apparent effort to infiltrate the defense attorneys who represent the accused, Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, and his alleged accomplices. And we've been talking about this for a few days now. The problem is that the FBI apparently spoke to a member of one of the defense teams after church and got him or her to sign a document that indicated an ongoing informant role. Now, this is highly inappropriate. This is misconduct, official misconduct by the FBI. And so it has put the proceedings on hold and turned the whole issue into finger-pointing. Because in order for the defense lawyers to defend themselves against the infiltration of an FBI agent into their ranks, it puts at risk the interests of their clients. This is an untenable conflict, and it has been created by the FBI. So we'll keep watching that one as well. In Boston, the attorneys for Dzhokhar Tsarnaev have offered some glimpses of their strategy in terms of the documents that they are requesting. And it appears that they will try to explain to the court and to a jury the relationship between the surviving Tsarnaev brother and his older brother, Tamerlan, who was 26 when he was reportedly killed by authorities last April outside of Boston. So the defense is suggesting they'll delve deeper into the dynamic of the Tsarnaev family, including the relationships that the brothers had with two sisters and their parents. And David Bruck, one of the attorneys, said, "I don't think there's anybody who's seen what's unfolded in the last year who doesn't understand that if the government's indictment is true, this is about a family. And the search for an understanding of what's happening is in large measure a story of this family and the relationships between people in it." Now, prosecutors have agreed to a request from the defense lawyers to turn over immigration files on the entire family. And let's include the uncle, the guy who was living with a CIA agent in suburban Washington for over a year. Yeah. Sarny is his name, and we need to know a little bit more about him. They also need information, in my view, about the killing, the FBI killing of Ibrahim Todashev in Orlando. President Jimmy Carter, a man who has done great things, greater things as an ex-president than, frankly, I thought he did as president, has signed a letter with nine other Nobel Peace Prize winners urging rejection of the Keystone XL pipeline. This letter was published as an ad on the Politico website. It's the first time that Carter has taken a position on the pipeline. The Bush senior and junior both support it. Bill Clinton has been a little bit cautious about expressing any opinion about Keystone XL because his wife was Secretary of State, could have approved it or rejected it when she was in office. And, of course, this is shaping up as a lingering issue that could affect her run for president in 2016. And, you know, one would ask, is Obama going to evolve on the Keystone XL pipeline the way he evolved on marriage equality? And in advance of its publication in the Sunday magazine, the New York Times has posted a lengthy article by Joe Becker entitled How the President Got to I Do on Same-Sex Marriage. It's quite revealing, very interesting, focuses on the work of a guy who I've met once named Chad Griffin. Griffin is a political operator from Hollywood, and his mentor has been Rob Reiner. Yeah, meathead from All in the Family, a great actor and director. And Reiner's been involved in politics here in California. He sponsored a ballot measure in the late 90s that put a 50-cent tax on tobacco. That raised hundreds of millions of dollars for early childhood intervention through a system called First Five that was set up under the initiative. Chad Griffin was very much involved with that. And just in full disclosure, I produced some radio programs that were funded by First Five. And as a result, we had some meetings with Rob Reiner, and Chad Griffin was present. So that's how I know him. And in this, it details how over a period of time during the first Obama term, Chad Griffin kept talking to the president, to the first lady, and to Joe Biden and others in the administration, urging them to change their position. And what is exposed here is the clear calculation of Barack Obama. It is clear that before he announced his changed position, he had personally supported marriage equality for a long time, going all the way back to a failed run for Congress in Chicago around 2000 or 2001. And so, for political purposes, Obama put gays under the bus, and then he miraculously lifted the bus off them toward the end of the first term. Now, the signals that were being sent were this is going to have to wait for the second term. But then the polling showed that things were shifting. Even Republicans were supporting marriage equality. And that it was all moving much faster than anyone expected. Then there was the Joe Biden moment that apparently was not calculated as it appeared. He kind of slipped, and then Obama, on the advice of Republican operative Ken Mellman, gave an interview to a reporter at ABC Television where he announced his position had evolved but was very cautious in the way he expressed it. And I think this is a fascinating look at the mind of Barack Obama, at the pure political calculation that is behind so much of what he does. I hope you'll read, I'll put up a link to it, and I hope you'll read the lengthy New York Times article about this. It's pretty interesting. I escaped from the land of the Buckeyes. I grew up in Ohio. And now, a law passed by the Ohio legislature may be taken up by the U.S. Supreme Court. It makes it illegal to knowingly or recklessly make false statements about a candidate during an election. What? You're saying it's against the law to lie as a candidate? I think that's un-American. I think the big problem is enforcing it. And who determines whether a political comment is true, is a matter of opinion? It might be slightly factually off, but represent the First Amendment right of an individual to express him or herself. So I don't know if the judges will, the justices of the Supreme Court will take that up. Might just be too much work for them. And finally today, a French judge has dismissed charges against Bob Dylan. And this arose from an interview that he gave to Rolling Stone, where he made a comparison between Croatians and Nazis. And the quote here is, "Blacks know that some whites didn't want to give up slavery. If you've got a slave master or a Klan in your blood, blacks sense that. That stuff lingers to this day. Just like Jews can sense Nazi blood and the Serbs can sense Croatian blood." Now, I don't know that these comments are hateful. I don't know how thoughtful or considerate they are. But Bob Dylan will not have to report to court in France to face those charges. He's free to record a new album with T-Bone Burnett, and I think that's what he's going to do. Thanks for joining me for News and Comment. You are authorized to share this podcast with absolutely anyone, and I'm Peter B. Collins.
Happy trails to you until we meet again. Happy trails.